Carolyn, I pass the talking stick to you.
Thank you, Marita Roberts. And so, greetings. Let's go into that quiet space now and just take a few deep breaths. Breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. Deep breath that way or whatever breathing protocol that you like to do. Just go into that heart center. Like to call in those seven galactic directions today. That's that good Mayan calendar way. So let's go there with that rattle. From the eastern house of light, may wisdom open in the dawn upon us so that we may see things clearly. And from the northern house of night, may wisdom mature among us so that we may see everything from within. From the western house of transformation, may wisdom be transformed into right action so that we might accomplish what must be done. From the southern house of eternal sun, may right action give us the harvest so that we might enjoy the fruits of the planetary being. From the upper house of paradise, where the star people and the ancestors gather, may their blessings reach us now. From the lower house of the earth, may the beating of the crystal planet heart bless us with its harmony so that we might end war. From the central source of the galaxy, which is everywhere at once, may everything be recognized as the light of mutual love. And so it is in Loch Esh. We are another ourselves. And so I thought I'd like to take a moment to do the solfeggio tone for our dear ones out there looking for the good sounds. I have to hear them. The fork with me. And let's hope I can read these with these glasses. Oh, yeah. So we'll start with Root 396. And I don't know whether you'll hear them or not with this, so we'll just see what happens.
Carolyn, can you hear us? Carolyn?
Yeah.
We are not hearing anything. So
you're not hearing anything at all? Okay.
No.
Okay, well then let's go on and talk about the Mayan calendar. And just know that these residences are here among us. This is 528. You can't hear it. I apologize. But maybe when I'm on Skype sometime, I can do that again.
Okay.
So I'd like to just go ahead and discuss the Mayan calendar and transition that way. Here we are in the year of 10 Ish. That magician and that manifestation, and we're in the wave of Chulin right now on tone number 9, which is one of the pillar tones. That's where we turn that corner in the wave. Chulin is the monkey. So we're working with our magical way. And we're, all these days have been in the core days for 19 days. This is Kawak. This is the 19th day of the core days. So we have one more day in these core days where we're enjoying that continuity of all life in our lives, the synchronicity in allowing our body and our mind and soul to be in alignment. So 9 Kawak is what we have today. And Kawak is that storm energy. So it's a visionary aspect. It's about creating transformation for others and lighting clear thoughts. Gives us that possibility of freedom and that power of catalyzing. Good time to surrender any addictions to crisis or despair or fear, any illusions of separation or separateness. So use this storm energy today as we do our work. With that 9 activation turn, there's expanded cycle. And then tomorrow we have it's Friday, it's a 10, a how. So we have that manifestation of this last core day, and that manifestation is a how that of that solar glyph of cosmic consciousness. So it's moving forward, it's taking that leap, it's transforming, it's rising to Christ consciousness. And so very powerful day with that manifestation tone. What we got going for the whole year. So work with that. Your manifestation of intention tomorrow with that energy. And then on Saturday at 11 Unish, we start a new union. It'll be the 8th union. And we finish those core days on Friday, and then the new union begins. Actually going up, we're still in the center of the matrix, and so this union will have those 10 portal days in it. So we have 5 days of regular days and then 10 portal days together as really the core of our being on the right side, those organs on the right side of our body will be affected, worked on, aligned, whatever needs to happen. We have that emphasis in the core of our being that way. So that's what's happening in this union. So it's 20 days, like all of them. And it's the 8th union. And it starts on Saturday with that 11 tone of letting go which no longer serves us. Disintegration, dissonance, change. Also the spectral tone. It's the tone of the vision quest. So the time to choose free will and liberty over death and decay. And so that's the nature of the energy on Saturday in the Niche, that dragon energy, that mother energy, beginning unity. And then on Sunday... And
Saturday also is a new moon. Or full moon.
12. Pardon?
Saturday, oh, wait a minute, I'm a week ahead of myself. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
I was looking at full moon, and it's a week away. I'm jumping ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, we're in first quarter this week. So, and then Sunday, we have a 12 eek on Sunday, and that's the wind and the spirit and communication. So do that with that crystal clarity that we get with that 12 energy, the complex stability, the unity of polarity, very powerful tone to work with our ancestors and spirit guides and make those connections on Sunday. And then on Monday, we finish up this wave of doing the monkey with 13 oxballs a night. So that's a good day to work with our abundance and work with that night energy. It's an artist aspect about participation. So work with that on Monday, and then Tuesday we begin a new wave. And this wave is the wave of Khan, the seed. So So it's the energy of the opening the seed, and it's the flowering of our ideas. So a great way that begins on Tuesday with the one con, and then on Wednesday at 2 Qichang, which is the snake, that serpent energy of transformation and getting our old skins and working with that polarity and stability of the two energies. And then when we come back on Thursday, we begin the 10 portal days I mentioned with a 3 Kini. So it's really great to have these portal days in this wave of con. That's a fun way to approach this work, this multidimensional work with that flowering of our ideas. And so Thursday when we come back, that'll be the first one of those portal days with that 3 energy of activation and Kini linking us between the worlds, linking between worlds. And so let us link between the dimensions with this seed energy as we do this work. And so it looks like a good week to me. We're just cruising. And so that completes my Mayan calendar.
Okay, and then did you have anything else on the calendar that you wanted to announce for your classes, or are you you still need more time to get that list
together?
Yeah,
I do need more time. After I work through a couple bushels of corn and a couple bushels of tomatoes, I'm going to work on a calendar.
Right. Well, I understand that. Same thing going on here, so... Well, we thank you so much for opening and getting us started here on our Thursday night Stargate Roundtable. So thank you very much, Rain Bird. And I was not able to reach Annie Rose, so I'm not sure what's happening with her, but we won't have an astrology report from her yet tonight. So I'm going to pass the talking stick to Tara and Rama. And Rama, tell us who you talked to this week.
Greetings. Got to talk into this machine.
Greetings.
Greetings.
Hey, we hear you loud and clear.
Okay. It has been a wild, hairy week. And all we are watching, aside from the hair dance, and I do mean a wild hair dance, think about it. As he is front and center, what's going on in the background all around the planet?
That's who is front and center.
Donald Trump.
Oh, the hair dance.
Yeah, well, all the media is focused on Mr. Hare and his way he's going to fix the country. What's going on behind the scenes? And what is going on behind the scenes is, I could just say, we are so damn close to...
So darn close?
Yes. Full disclosure... And first contact, it's already happening in many sections of this planet, whether the official governments have talked about it or not. And at the same time, the 13 families, you know, it's like they're lemmings. They're onward rush to war, and they're going to go over the cliff. And they can't seem to recognize that there is, you know.
That there even is a cliff.
That's right.
They don't know that yet.
And what I have been hearing is they have very little time, if any, left. In fact, I think they're on overtime, and they just don't know it, and somebody needs to ring the bell or blow the whistle, or it might just be the energies that is called Wave X coming in. They tried to play with the CERN Super Collider this week, and that didn't work. The Galactic shut it down. Larry and Curly told me that, and they probably won't be able to turn it back on again. And for whatever reasons, yet, what I have been hearing is things are moving so fast.
They need to, because there's things that are going wrong. It's equally as fast.
Yeah. As many good things going on that are moving onward and upward, they are the 13 families creating heaven and hell at the same time on many levels. And I will say this again, that the deal with Iran will go through, and the Looney Tunes have nothing to say about it because it's on a higher level here. Even though they're lying about the so-called imminent war between Russia and NATO.
Well, there was a gentleman that was arrested and sentenced in Russia.
Yes.
And what the Estonians are saying is that he was abducted from Estonia, and he was on some kind of an intelligence mission. So he had a gun, and he had some documents to prove what he was doing, but he got abducted into Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're saying, and Rama didn't get to check this yet.
No.
What I am saying, and what we know about, is because it's been said on another way, on RT and other places, that NATO is doing these things in Ukraine, having border military stuff all ready to go.
Skirmishes, blaming it on the Russians, and it's our black ops.
Yeah, and it has nothing to do with Russia at all in the Ukraine. Yet NATO's got full military fast-tracking going on in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and the Bulgarian states, and they're literally planning to have a war with Russia.
Right.
And they're saying on the news in the Western media that Russia is planning to do the same.
And that is not true.
Well, I'm going to tell you what. Russia's not going to let them just do that.
No. That's where my father, who art in heaven, comes in, and I leave the talking stick up to him.
There's more.
Yeah.
There's 2 million Yemenis children that are just plain old bones with a little skin squeezed over them. And the conditions in Yemen are catastrophic.
They are.
And, you know, the richest oil nation, Saudi Arabia, is bombing the poorest nation in the whole region. And that's supposedly our ally. And President Hadi, that's not being president at the moment since the Houthis got a hold of him, and then the Saudis got him back, and he's been hanging out in Saudi Arabia. So anyway, he's an asset of the United States, even though, you know, what's going on there is being done by the Saudis.
Yes.
And the big reason is not about the Houthis, or there's a civil war going inside each one of the states or provinces, I'm not sure what they call them over there, in Yemen. But each area is having its own individualized civil war. And the civilians are not, the regular civilians are not involved in any of this. And the Saudis on top of that are bombing it. And then they destroyed a port where food and medicine and fuel can come into the, and water can come into the country. So these people have no fuel, no medicine, no water, and no, what did I say? No fuel, no water, no medicine, and no food. And so this is what you're seeing. And I mean, I just, you know, tracking stories where a mother's child had some kind of an infection in their lungs, and that's from all the stuff that's going on in the atmosphere. And she had no fuel, so she walked and walked, and it took her almost 2 days. And by the time they got her, he was in such bad shape that he died. And I mean, these are not unusual stories. These are the conditions that are going on. And there are no rules. There are no rules.
And ultimately, the empire over here is the cause of it.
No, it's not just that. What are we doing at being allied with Saudi Arabia in the first place?
I'm saying there's an issue with that.
It's called the Bush-Clinton crime family. Yes, it is. You're right about that. Yet, there's... I know that your message was from the king or somebody. It's been some months ago that in right timing, Barack was going to cut off funding to Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
I don't think that's happened yet.
No, it hasn't.
No, so, I mean, what is right timing?
I would say that they did something very, very ugly today, Saudi Arabia, by bombing something over there, and the whole world is pretty upset about it. And I'll just say that, you know, all of it is about a sinking ship that is the old order, and at the same time, all these things that are going on, the frequencies are moving so fast and so high. Our friends are in the atmosphere, and they are doing stuff. I am not at liberty to say because I don't know. And if I did, I would. Yet, I know what we are watching is a televised horror show that's nonstop. But, you know, I used to have a friend out there, and he called the folks in Congress zombies and vampires. And not all of them are like that. Yet, what we have been watching since they've been on vacation is things are getting a little more and more polarized and crystallized. And go Bernie. This is what I can say. Bernie is moving the mountain to Mohammed.
Okay, so also in... They decapitated, ISIL decapitated the head of a 82-year-old amazing archaeologist that spent his entire life working on Palmyra's archives, you know, the ruins there, the ancient ruins there. And
there's a lot of things in, you know, the Syria that are sidereal technology from when the Anunnaki were part living there, and eventually they're going to find that stuff if they haven't already. And because they don't have the consciousness or the frequency, they won't be able to use it. I'm just saying.
Got those sidereal weapons?
They are placed in certain archaeological areas around Syria. Aleppo is one of them. Damascus is another.
Oh.
Yeah. And they...
Who placed them there?
The ancient Anunnaki people.
Oh. So does Bashir.
They're like the zero-point modules that...
I know, but does Bashir al-Assad's government know that?
Some of his top inner circle know about it as well as him, and they're just praying and hoping against hope that, you know, somebody doesn't find these technologies. 'Cause,
oh, so they don't have any intention of using them. If they know where they are, why don't they?
They don't know how to use them.
They don't.
No, because the knowledge kind of got lost in their history, you know, where they, you know, took up Islam instead of the universal understanding that we're galactic citizens. And
well, you know, that's interesting because, you know, the ETs, quote-unquote, tampered with nuclear weapons places all over the place.
Yes.
And that was featured in the history of... in the citizens' hearings disclosures, the CHD and they were produced by Paradigm Research Group.
Mm-hmm.
Executive director of that is Dr. Stephen Bassett, not Dr. Stephen Greer. Dr. Stephen Bassett. That's very interesting, just to know that. And then a video of that testimony was finally sent to every member of our Congress in November of last year, just bringing things up. And then, since January of this year, 2015, the Paradigm Research Group has been conducting a congressional hearing initiative to place the nuclear tampering and other ET-related issues and events before five key committees: House and Senate Intelligence Committee, House and Senate Science and Space Committee, and then that's 2-4, and then one more is the Senate Homeland Security Committee. So that's five key committees.
And that's a big deal.
And Dr. Bassett said, it's my hope Dr. Mitchell's continued efforts to alert the American people about the ET presence to the human race will help Paradigm Research Group bring this matter finally into a presidential campaign. Election after election passes with not a single candidate speaking. In other words, they want this campaign to be engaged, and they want it to be that issue to reach hundreds of millions of people, and that already hundreds and millions of people worldwide know all of these things to be true and real, and that it's a total disgrace that the wealthiest country on earth is not leading the way at the moment.
Yes.
And that was a very important piece of the news, too. And then Lady Master Nada.
Yes.
Lady Master Nada said, this was like, yesterday was the 19th, on the 18th, Tuesday, she said to Rama, as Nasara occurs, all these dictators are guilty of war crimes, and as the presiding judge on the Solar Tribunal, meaning there are nine other solar representatives on that tribunal from other solar systems that are in our neighborhood,
yes,
that are being affected on the galactic level by our shenanigans already that we've been doing on this level at this solar system. That's why they're there. And she's the presiding judge over all of these representatives. And she says, as that presiding judge, I am not at liberty to discuss the whole case because, quote unquote, it's pending. The investigation is still going on. No more words and good day. And basically what she's saying is that she's saying without saying that you're not on my paycheck, Rama, and none of your beeswax.
Right.
But we must be perfectly clear right now that the violations are so out of hand.
Astronomical war crimes.
Oh.
That's the only way I know how to describe it.
I know, and in you know, I think we mentioned this last week. I just wanted to say it again. They're doing chemical weapons killings and blaming it on ISIL, but it's really because that police is funded by us. It's really us, meaning McCain and Lindsey Graham and the collaborative Nazi political GOP, you might say. And
the Black Ops funded bullies, basically.
Along with Prince Bandar Bush, our Saudi neighbor, and along with Netanyahu, that are using these weapons on these innocent people. And now, in the Palestinian refugee camp right outside of Damascus, typhoid fever is going. Mm-hmm. And there are 11 cases that are ongoing right now, and they have no medicine, they have no help, they're drinking dirty water. That's where they're getting it from. Oh, my goodness. And that's the same thing, you know, they're trying to explain the situation that's coming down in Yemen, and every time you hear the explanation, you know where the lies are. There was a very excellent young woman that was talking about this. Let's see. Oh, and in Cairo, there are 3 explosions around Cairo, Egypt today.
Yeah.
In the vicinity of a state security building. And in China, officials are worried about toxic contamination and possibly another explosion at the site of the massive explosion site that happened last week. Teams of chemical experts have entered the disaster area in Tianjin for the first time today. The experts stayed only 40 minutes each to limit their exposure. The city's mayor accepted responsibility for the so-called accident. I saw this somewhere. This was an earlier report. Something like ammonium nitrate is the possible cause. This was on NHK out of Japan. Mm-hmm. Of the deadly explosions last week in the warehouse in Tianjin, ammonium nitrate is the suspected cause. It is a highly hazardous material used in making explosives. And I just want to mention that the whole neighborhood is completely irate because they needed to be informed if they were going to move in there. And they said, why didn't you tell us what we're up against to come into this neighborhood? And they're filing huge, massive lawsuit. More than 200 tons of this ammonium nitrate were stored near this blast. And they said somewhere a fire was started. They don't know how this happened. It just started inside the plant. And more than 40 kinds of chemicals are reportedly stored in that plant. Oh, my goodness. Also in that area, 114 dead, 13 still unidentified, 65 people remain missing in action. So the residents can't come back because the pollution in the area is of this kind of material, and it's just not amenable. So anyway, senior firefighting officials are saying highly toxic sodium cyanide is also in there, as well as nerve gas is in there. Oh my gosh. And it's in the air samples. Nerve gas and sodium cyanide is in the air samples. The police suspect the two separate explosions in Bangkok, it's another topic, were carried out by the same group. They say the bombs had similar features. The national police chief said bombs were made from pipes and were of equal force. He suggested bombings were intended to deal a blow to the military-led interim government. 20 so far dead, 125 injured at the shrine blast. The other bomb went into the water, so it didn't hurt anybody. Another blast occurred. It went off the bridge and into the water. Another blast occurred in Bangkok, on Tuesday. Yeah, it was thrown off the bridge. Okay. And President Putin visited Crimea yesterday. And he got up there and he said, the people of Crimea determine their own future. They voted to reunite with Russia. That is it. End of story. That's put it as precisely as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are living a peaceful life. They are so relieved. In other words, that area is completely off limits because Russia's got it covered.
Mm-hmm.
Oof. And they're getting double the pension funds that they were getting out of the capital of Ukraine, Kiev. The Nazi collaborating bunch that are in there. And I guess that Poroshenko got his life threatened within a hair of breath of being not here somehow in the last little while. Okay, so also they used this arena back into the Palmyra,
Syria.
Palmyra. That's how you. Palmyra. You know, there's an arena there, an ancient Roman arena. And yesterday, ISIL executed 25 people that they decided didn't belong there, and they had a crowd. They had a whole crowd of people filled to the max watching. What's this picture about?
Lions and Rome.
If we're not at the end, I don't know what we call this. Okay, so Kunotori 5, that is a rocket ship out of Japan, is ready for liftoff. Officials at Japan's aerospace agency said making final preparation for a supply mission to the International Space Station. The H-2B rocket is scheduled to lift off late Wednesday, so it went off yesterday evening.
Mm-hmm.
This was Tuesday's news. From the Tanegashima Space Center in South Japan. The German parliament overwhelmingly approves the Greek bailout. 454 MPs voted yes, 113 voted against. The Thai police offer a reward of more than 25,000 euros for anyone who has information about Bangkok's bomber. The number of migrants looking for European El Dorado, meaning city of gold for them, keeps increasing. Last month alone, 107,500 people reached European Union's borders. 86 billion euros, $95 billion. That package did get approved. Yet, the 113 no's were from Angela Merkel's coalition party. Mm-hmm. Remember, she didn't get in by very much this last time, so she had to form a coalition with another group. And so all 113 of these people said no to her deal that she's been trying to push through. And it's the same way that it was in July. Yet this time, we have to note that there were fewer votes in total cast. And it is expected, though not yet confirmed, that a high percentage of those who remained far from the Bundestag, and this happened yesterday, they stayed away so to avoid casting their vote, and that they were all members of Angelico's own party, and that could be seen as a protest against threats that were made from the party leaders, especially the chief whip, Volker Kauder. So it is significant, very significant. And didn't Tom the Cat say so too, or whoever mm-hmm. you talked to, was it Tom the Cat?
Yes.
And I said this is extremely significant because this is going to take Angela Merkel all the way down.
Yep.
So it's so significant because it also shows that Miss Merkel was not able to convince rebels in her coalition to come back into a line to agree to this deal. And so we'll have to see how it will affect her authority. Yet it could be seen as a not so little dent for her power in mm-hmm. her party, in government. Let me just go back here. Oh, yes.
We have about 10 minutes before our guest, so that just to keep you updated on the time.
Thank you, Marita Robert. Okay. I thought this was really good, so I transcribed this too. Let me see where it begins. Okay. Okay. This starts, it's about Iran. And there's an artist, an Iranian artist, and her name is Shirin Nashat. And she's saying, I made this film because I felt it's important for it to speak to the Westerners about our history as a country of Iran. And then I think it's called In Context, Iran Distrust, that all of you in the West seem to remember Iran after the Islamic Revolution, that Iran once was a secular society, mm-hmm. and we had democracy. And this democracy was stolen from us by the American government.
That
and
makes
then
sense.
The
yeah.
reporter says in 2013, a declassified CIA document confirmed the seemingly populist uprising was American made to control oil interests and to smother a perceived communist threat. And they made sure you got that word perceived in there. One operative called it a real James Bond op. Mossadegh was captured as he lay weeping in his bed, clad in striped silk pajamas. In Rome, a bewildered young Shah prepared to fly home and install Zahedi as premier and to give Iran a pro-Western regime. Thus it was that the strategic little nation of Iran was rescued from the closing clutch of Moscow. Really?
Well, the Shah was not a nice guy at all.
Oh, okay. The legacy for Iranians, that Shirin says, was feeling control of their own political destiny slip away. Shirin says, this film also speaks to the Iranian people in asking them to return to their history and to look at themselves before they were so Islamicized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole country got Islamicized with our black ops helping the way all the way through. The way we looked and the way we played music in the way we had intellectual life, and most of all, in the way we fought for democracy, let us remember ourselves. Okay, and then Al Jazeera says, in Iran, Abrahami is a professor of Iranian and Middle Eastern history and politics at the City University of New York. Greetings, Professor. Good always to have you. The CIA orchestrated this coup 62 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranian hostage crisis happened 36 years ago. Isn't it time to get past this? And just to remind you, that was Bush Sr. that arranged that hostage thing with our CIA-influenced Ayatollah black operation in Iran. You know, the regime change guy. Okay, so Professor Ervand Abrahami, so his first name is Ervand, I think both had a deep effect on popular thinking in both countries. And it's become, I would say, part of national culture. It's like Pearl Harbor in the United States. It's a long, and I remind you all that FDR knew very well, and that it was Hitler and him working together, sorry to say, behind the scenes, our lovely little FDR. And that the United States planned that operation and executed it with the orders to be coming from Japan to make it look like so we could have a war. Oh, that's right. Okay, so it's like Pearl Harbor in the U.S. It's a long time ago, yet people know about it, yet they might not know about the details. And then Al Jazeera says, we have perfectly good relations with Japan now, ? And again, what a joke is that? You know, when Barack Obama was in Beijing and Japan was there too, three ninjas tried to murder Barack, sent personally by Shinzo Abe of Japan. Perfectly good relations, everybody, right? Professor Ervand, exactly. After a while, I think, now is the time where you get politicians in both Washington and Tehran, who are willing to say, well, the past is the past. Let's look at our national interests. And I think both the Obama administration and the Rouhani administration don't want to be bogged down in basically past history. They want to look at what is both countries' interests. Don't let her do that, Gonta. Change the scene. Okay, so the point that's being made here is not really being made clearly in the sense that with Nasara, everything is held accountable.
everything that wasn't correctly perceived in this conversation, because the culture has accepted it as the truth because the media is controlled. And that was another thing so interesting, because Nixon was the one that got the brainstorm of the agenda for the GOP. And as a result, Nixon wasn't able to raise the money, so he told Mr. Ailes, and Mr. Ailes knew this rich guy named Mr. Murdoch, and so Mr. Murdoch started Fox News, and the GOP agenda that we're still looking at today began that way. So you can thank Mr. Nixon. That's why he's pretty much the worst guy we've ever had up there. High treason, got away with it, along with a whole bunch of string of them after him. But anyway, so thus it was a strategic little nation. Let's see, where was I? Okay, and I think both the Obama administration and the Rouhani administration do not want to be bogged down in basically past history. Look at what is both countries' best interests. One more question about past history. Would that coup have happened had the CIA and somebody said the United Kingdom as well not intervened? And Professor Irvine said, no way. You can see from the CIA documents that the Iranians, in fact, were not organizing a coup at all. In fact, the CIA had to give the Shah an ultimatum to go with the coup. The Shah himself was reluctant to go. They told him, we are going to go along with the coup. As you do not, we cannot guarantee you the throne afterward. So, in fact, this was a threat to the Shah. Mm. Not looking so pretty, are we? Okay, two more minutes. So Al Jazeera says, okay, I see. Now, given the inherent tensions that exist between the two countries, then how can this nuclear agreement go forward? Professor Irvine says, well, because I think both leaders, both here and there, are again not interested in questions of distrust. They are more interested in practical, let's say, insurances that there is not going to be cheating. And then Al Jazeera says, yet then we have all this recent news. We have the secret agreement with the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, that would allow Iran to use its own inspectors to investigate a very sensitive nuclear site in their military. We also have a missile agreement, apparently, with Russia and also General Soleimani, one of the most important military figures in Iran, right, traveling to Moscow, apparently in violation of UN sanctions. Isn't this all giving a lot of meat for the opponents of this deal? Professor Irvine says too much is being made of it. For instance, we don't know exactly what international UN agreement is yet, what the international UN agreement is yet. What I can see is they are talking about what was being done in Iran before 2003. So as we are talking again about past history, the CIA and 17 American intelligence agencies, yes, we have 17 of them, everybody, it's disgusting, have said, there's been no Iranian basically experimentation with nuclear weapons since 2003. Anything that was done would have been earlier. So as we are talking about inspections about past activities, we are talking about history. We are not talking about recent activity.
Then Al Jazeera says, you are talking about how Rouhani and President Obama want to move forward. Yet are you among the optimists who think that not only will this deal work, rather also that this could lead up to a broader improvement of relations between Iran and the West? Professor Irvine says, yes, I am an optimist. I think things will improve, yet I do not see a sort of friendly relations, an alliance between the United States and Iran. This, I think, is overblown. I think there is a fear in Israel somehow that Iran will become the United States' main ally in the region, thus replacing Israel. That is not possible. What you will get is much more of a normalization in which the danger of war is no longer there. The United States is assured that Iran is not interested in building nuclear bombs. And Iran gets the assurances from the United States that the United States is not out for regime change. And that is one of the major things the Iranians actually are concerned about. That's the end. I'm done. I pass the talking stick back to you, Marita Roberts. Marita? Marita?
I was muted and I was talking and you couldn't hear me.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, Mina?
Okay.
She usually calls in by herself, and she just called me on the phone and said that she was having trouble getting in. So we may have, Donald may have to try to call her, and he says, okay, so we'll be patient. There she is. Nope, call failed. We'll try it again.
He's making an attempt, yeah.
Right. Well,
I'll say, while they're trying to get a hold of Amina, I was just going to say that we're going to play Democracy Now! From, I believe, Tuesday. We're going to play it because it was so critical, because they interviewed a female and a male leader of Black Lives Matter, and then they interviewed David K. Johnston at the end. And it goes so deep into what we have. There's this phrase that the United States was conceived in liberty, yet it was founded in shackles. And that issue is white Anglo-Saxon male property owners, meaning that property means slave owners, were the only people that were heading up this country. And that has gone for a very long time, and it's not cleared up. But so that's the deeper sides of that. It was just amazing. So, and then David K. Johnston, he opened the book on Donald Trump's history, financially and morally, ethically, and his relationships with workers, where he didn't pay a lot of them, and he was very cruel and. You might say he used slave labor. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to be shared on that, so we're going to do that. Okay, we made it. We had talked long enough. Amina seems to be here, Marita.
Marita? Hello, Amina, can you hear us? Yes? Yes. Amina, can you hear us?
From what we can see here, Marita, it looks like it's trying to get her. It's not quite, the call is not quite coming through. Maybe we could get her telephone number and get her online that way.
Okay.
Do you have a phone number you can give to Doug that he can call her directly on?
I'm working on it.
Okay, thanks. So that'll be.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Now we hear you. Yes, we can. You're coming in loud and clear.
Just 1 minute.
It sounds like it left. Okay.
No, can you hear me now?
We can.
Right, oh, right. Good. Finally. Oh, wow.
We've had technical challenges, and I hear an echo. Do you have your phone open as well?
No, my phone is off.
Okay. All right. Well, our guest tonight is Omina. She has been here before and always has very good response and has offered many times for people to call in and ask questions. So we'll see if we can get that to happen for us tonight. So what are you going to tell us about or speak about, or what's your guidance for this evening?
Just 1 minute. Richard? Okay. All right. Now I'm off again. I can't hear
Marie. Well, we can hear you.
I can hear. Okay,
I can hear you.
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay.
Can you still hear me? Okay. Well, good evening, everybody. And
yes,
tonight
you.
Tonight my subject was going to be all about love. Okay. And the whole definition of love is an energy. You still can hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
I can hear you fine.
Okay.
Tell us about love.
Yes. And the definition is light, oneness, vitality, and eternal. So light is the greatest gift that holds the total essence of life. Love is the essence of reverence on a universal level for all rights, actions, and holds the capacity for us to manifest and feel all that we are. It illuminates the pathways of our soul's journey and enlightens our experiences when we've forgotten our spiritual heritage of oneness. And oneness is the essence of knowing that all will prevail and manifest into our realities of hopes, dreams, visions, that our soul wishes to create and experience. Without the essence of oneness, your soul will lack the vitality of life. And vitality is the essence of energy, the blue flame that radiates the glimmer of divinity at the heart of our souls. The heart of our souls is eternal because it is eternally connected to our spirit. And eternity is the essence of the God-Goddess gift to spirit, and spirit is their child. Therefore, love is eternal. Without love, we would wither up and die. Eternal love is a promise of love that is greater than any other energy source amongst all universes. The power of love has the ability to heal all souls' sorrows, wounds, and atrocity created by humankind. It never dies, and it's always available to all that are open to receiving. And that's a key word, open to receiving. It allows us to feel and express our feelings of hate, anger, joy, despair, grief, sadness, and happiness. When you experienced love, L-O-V-E, through your soul, you know without a doubt that the universe will never be without light. Feelings of oneness are vitality that will sustain us for all eternity. To know love is to experience joy, sadness, sorrow, grief, and pain. Love heals all sufferings and rejoices in all triumphs and is the thread that binds the God, Goddess, spirit, and souls together. This is the magic in being a spiritual being. With the magic of spirit, your soul is free to create at will whatever your personality desires. That's my definition of love.
Okay.
You still there?
Okay. So we are looking really at what the soul desires then.
Well, we're looking at the energy of love. The energy of love is very, very light. So it needs constant feeding. It's not like the dense feelings of the ego, because oftentimes the dense feelings of the ego are negative. And negative energy is very heavy, so it doesn't need an awful lot to feed it to keep it there. That's where love is a much lighter energy, and it's a constant consciousness in our being, so to speak, to look at everything and everyone with love. It doesn't mean to be involved. It just means to accept and just look at everybody with love and just send love to them, to anything, plants, anything in the earth. but especially humans, because that's who struggles the most with a lot of people equate love with lust and physical attraction and sexual energy. And there's nothing wrong with that if it's used in the proper sense rather than misused. When it's misused, then it gets into all the negative stuff. So I constantly try to remember that it's light and it's oneness and it's eternal and it's vitality. I mean, if you really are in the energy of love, you have a lot of vitality.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that feeds the soul. Definitely. It feeds our passion. It feeds our desires. It feeds everything. When you think about it. Like babies are universal. The majority of people in the world love babies. Babies invoke love.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just using that as an example.
Right.
So any questions about anything? It's kind of like our blueprint of the soul.
So how do we help people understand what this really is, because they have had so much feeding in the media and in all of our culture that there's a lot of misunderstanding about what that really is. So what can we do to help people understand that and to live it?
I think it's by example. I think if we love ourselves enough, we most certainly will be more accepting of other people who are lacking it or people that we may not even like. But if we accept that they're on their journey and we just bless them with love, I think that's a great example. It's really hard to live up to it because we're also human beings. But then again, it's about raising the consciousness. If people look at themselves and they wonder why relationships don't work, and I always ask, well, do you love yourself enough to allow somebody else to love you? And that's where we have to be open to receiving. And if we're open to receiving, the kind things that people do for us, even the little things that people do for us with gratitude, that invokes love. I mean, that brings out that energy. It's like we all have it in us. We just need someone sometimes to help us bring it out. But it's all there, and it's about learning to feel compassion for people that are not there yet, that lack self-love, because that's where it begins. Mm-hmm. It begins with self-love, and that's total of acceptance of who we are, the good, bad, the ugly, whatever it is that we accept as part of who we are. And then forgive ourselves for whatever it is we need to forgive ourselves with. That's all done with love. And that's a great example to show somebody else. And I know it's much easier said than done. So it's where would you be without love? That'd be my question.
Well, it would not be how can we live without that energy? That's what came up for me is, like, without that energy, it's like a big recipe, a big ingredient in the cake of life is missing. And so the cake doesn't turn out well because that has to be a part of it in order for it to be a good cake.
Absolutely. And it's about everyday life. It's about loving what you do. It's about loving, admiring, even if it's around looking at nature and just loving what it gives back to us. Even that's one way of being able to practice love. A lot of people love their animals because animals love them back unconditionally. I mean, animals are great teachers for that. So we even learn, even if we learn from the animals, how the animals love us conditionally, we can just give that back to the animals and even one person in our lives. Unconditionally doesn't mean that you agree with everything they do and you don't have to be involved in it. It just means that you love them unconditionally. You don't have to like them. You just have to love them unconditionally and just bless them on their journey. And that begins to grow that energy. It begins to raise the vibrations and it begins to grow that energy. So it's about bringing it into the consciousness, because everything begins with a thought. So you can think anger, you can think love, you can think hate, or you can think love, you can think energy and think love. If the love is the first part in it, the rest is easier to deal with. It's easier to deal. I tell people all the time, detach with love. You don't have to punish the person. You don't have to put them down. You just detach with love. If they're not the way you want them to be or abusive, you walk away and you detach with love. And that's a lot of practice to do. And honor the emotions, but that doesn't mean you have to always express them. Just honor what you're feeling. You don't have to act on them. And that's self-love. Mm-hmm. It's self-preservation, too. So I just thought it's a good subject, and maybe a lot of people might misunderstand it, but, hey, my job is to raise consciousness.
Well, Mina.
Yes.
And Marita, I was thinking of jumping in here. When you first talked about this and Marita was saying there's an ingredient missing, the first thing I thought about was that story that Jesus talked about called the story about the leavening.
Yeah.
Isn't that the ingredient called love?
The leaven? I thought he was talking about bread. From my Catholic religion ground, I thought he was talking about bread.
Well, yes, I know it's the ingredient in bread, you know, but then, you know, they said to eat unleavened bread. I guess that's not a good analogy, but.
Well, I guess it would be really what he was saying was that you need to share the bread with others.
Yeah.
And I think that's how the love is shown. If you're near your last bite and the person beside you is starving, you give that to them. That's an act of love.
Yeah.
Okay, because it's an essence, it's an energy. And of course, he was a being on the earth. He hadn't ascended at that point, but that was his last trip, you might say, to the earth before he ascended. And he most certainly came in all about peace and love. And he came in a very unpopular time when it was all about domination and it was male ruled. No offense to all the males that might be listening. And Jesus was definitely a feminine essence. And, of course, he was all about forgiveness, and he was all about love, and he was all about compassion. And he worked an awful lot amongst the poor, which was below his status in life, because he was a tradesman, and that was a higher level of society at that time in the ethnic group that he lived in. But definitely was a great example of unconditional love. There's no doubt about that.
Yes, and
Let me just interrupt here just a moment to say that if one of our listeners wish to call in, you can use the toll-free line for Canada and the United States, which is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, or you can call 530-413-9537. So this way you'll be able to ask a question and talk directly to Amina. Okay, now go ahead.
And they can also call in and ask whatever questions they want to. It's never limited to the subject that I bring up. I mean, that's just part of the service, so to speak, if the public are listening and they want to call and ask anything they want to. So,
okay.
And we'll tell them with love.
Right. Okay, Tara, you were speaking when I interrupted you.
Yeah, I had a call from a sister today, and she was really getting to some deeper questions about love. And, you know, it's in a relationship that's a marriage, and she's a little bit older, and she wants to have a baby, yet she's becoming more and more aware that some basic principles, like you were saying at the beginning, Amina, to have compassion on those who are not quite there yet, meaning that some people have a much deeper understanding and therefore can have a deeper commitment to consciousness or higher love.
Right.
And And then there's other aspects, like you said, you know, you can have sex and you can do all these other things and that's all fine and dandy. Yet the deeper principle comes up here, especially as you're thinking about having a child. I mean, everything changes. Da, 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 da.
Well, it's a huge commitment to be a parent. I mean, that's definitely one of the greatest acts of love you could talk about. I mean, the sexual energy is the highest energy that's on this earth. And if it's used properly, then, and especially if it's done for the higher good and especially done out of love, then that's a great experience for anyone to experience. Right. And if people don't misuse their sexual energy, then they have a much happier life. But we're not that simple. I wish we were, but we're not that simple. Most people are not that simple. And most people are out searching for love through sex and gets them in a lot of trouble. As where if there's enough love in themselves, then they're going to be a lot more conscious of how they allow to share themselves with other people. So it really is, you know, one of the ways that we can definitely help people is to challenge their belief systems, because belief systems change all the time. And when we challenge them, we break up some of that little bit of energy that's in their brain that has a formed belief system by giving them new information, and they think about it, then that begins to break up the old belief system. It's like the child teaching the child not to burn themselves on the stove. Some people make them burn themselves on the stove. Then the child has new information not to go near anything hot. It's not the way to teach. I'm using that as an example.
Okay.
Right.
We have Annie on line one wanting to ask a question. Can you hear me, Annie?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
You're perfect. Speak up.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you, Annie.
Okay, the name is Anna.
Okay.
Hello, Anna.
Hi, Omena. Greetings. I love what you are teaching about love. It's so spot on.
Thank you.
Love also encompasses the energy of non-attachment. This allows us the freedom to love unconditionally, and I just wanted to add that.
Thank you.
It's such a coincidence. I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
No, I was just thanking you.
Oh, you're welcome. I do have a question for you, Omena, and it's coincidental that something that's been on my mind for quite some time is all about love, and it's about the first love that each one of us has had when we split from one to two, and so it's known as our better half. And I wanted to ask you if you could talk about what that a lot of people call them twin flame soulmates, whatever. It's the same thing. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that aspect of ourselves and if that's partially why we feel loneliness often. And also, I'd like a personal reading about my other half, and I'd like any information you can give about that one to me at this time. Thank you.
Okay, you have three or four questions in there, so you want me to address the first love?
Yeah, the concept about that first love, but your understanding of that in spirit and through incarnations and all that sort of thing.
Well, first love usually happens somewhere in our teens, and that's when our karma begins. And what happens is if we meet somebody, we get to experience that first. It's part of lust. It's part of discovering our sexuality. It's part about being special that somebody else loves us. And sometimes what happens is during those years, we make absolute decisions about love. And what we fail to understand is that when we find someone that loves us, they're bringing the love out in us, except our ego decides that they love us more. And if that doesn't last, let's say, if it breaks up, oftentimes first love do, then we think there's something wrong with us because we weren't good enough to be loved. So then the karma begins, and that's part of the growing, and it's part of the maturing. There's nothing like love. There's nothing like young love, and there's nothing like an infatuation. And I think that infatuations are meant to be enjoyed, and they're meant to be lived up to the fullest, whatever way that needs to go. But then at the same time, we put so much expectations on that first love, because we expect that person to be all and everything to us, and nobody can be all and everything to us. But that's the expectations that we put on. And let's say then if we're rejected or it doesn't work out for the other person, we oftentimes as teenagers make absolute decision, I'm never going to let anyone do that to me again. And they shut down emotionally and they don't allow themselves to fully experience the next love.
I'm going to assume that everyone on this call has had that experience, and I appreciate your understanding about that. But my question was really directed at the original creation, when a spirit being split into male and female. They are often called a twin flame. Are you familiar with that?
Twin flames rarely ever incarnate at the same time. Soulmates incarnate all the time. Usually, spirit is of the feminine and the masculine essence, and only one part will incarnate at one time. Spirit flames incarnate at the same time in order to achieve change or some greatness on the earth, okay? And they will come together. Like Jesus and Mary Magdalene were twin flames because they came to change the whole concept of what belief systems were, and they wanted to teach that there was a spiritual life beyond our physical reality. So they rarely come in together. Soulmates meet up all the time because they have contracts to meet up with each other, to teach each other, or to finish whatever they didn't finish before. So there is a little, this is my belief system, there is a little difference between soulmates and twin flames. Twin flames are spiritual and soul does the journey.
May I ask then, since that is not possible for my twin flame to be in physical form, may I ask if there's a soulmate in my life, coming into my life in the winter years of my life?
Well, Anna, can I speak frankly?
Of course.
Okay, well, you have a great desire to be loved.
Yes.
And one of the blocks from bringing the person that you want to share that love with you or to receive that love from that person is that you there's some fear there, but you also don't love yourself enough yet to open up. So you might want to think about taking stock of who you are and just loving all of it.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's going to open up for.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Okay.
So if I do that, there's likely to be somebody. Is this correct?
If you have a great desire, stop wishing for someone to come into your life because the universe will keep you wishing. You have to be very precise about what it is you want. And you have to be very precise about even the gender. Okay?
Yes.
You have to be very precise. Yes, you have to be very precise because if you want a great love in there, you have to be open to whatever form it's going to come in unless you are very, very specific. Okay?
I'm aware of that, and I have been doing that, being very specific in what I want, including the gender.
Okay, so now in order to bring the person into your life, you have to love yourself unconditionally.
Okay.
Because them to love you unconditionally.
Yes.
Yes. So energy attracts like energy.
Yes.
So if you love yourself unconditionally, then you will bring that person into your reality and they will love you unconditionally. And you're going to get tested on it when he shows up, he or she shows up.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
I like to be forewarned so I can do some homework.
It's just practice every day about loving yourself unconditionally. Do not judge yourself and do not put yourself down. Just love yourself unconditionally. Deal with the fears. You have some fear of rejection. There's a part of you yes. thinks that you're not good enough.
Yes, that's true.
So you need to heal that. Remember, that's a okay. false belief system.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Yes. Thank you, precious one.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have Kate on line two. Can you speak up, Kate? Kate, can you hear me?
She must be struggling
Kate,
with the phone.
Can you open your line? I hear some noise going on. Okay, maybe she'll have to call in again.
Right, that's possible.
888-429-5471. Or 530-413-9537. Those are a couple numbers that you can use. Is there anybody here on the team that would like to ask a question while we're waiting for her or someone else to call in?
Well, Omina, when you were talking to Anna and telling her, you know, that that there's a little bit of a feeling of self-worth issue there. I mean, as we're all in these forums, is this
speak up, Tara. We can't hear you.
Are you on speakerphone, Tara?
Oh, my goodness. I forgot to have that thing up to my mouth.
Oh, thank you. That's much better because you were phased away.
Sorry, I'm in La La Land about the machinery. Forgive me, please. Okay. When you were speaking to Anna about... you know, the idea that self-worth issues were part of what is up about this desire to have love in your life.
Right.
And, okay, so it goes back to this question I have, too, because at this time, and I think especially my take is that especially at this time, it's the first time in the history of humanity that you might say
I am.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
Okay. Oh, no, we're all here.
I hear all of you.
Nope.
We're all here.
Yeah, we're all here.
Yeah, okay. But we talked to Anna already, and we called on Kate, and she didn't answer.
Amy, okay.
Okay, all right. Kate,
thank you.
Can you hear us?
Hi. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Speak up.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, I have such problems with technology.
We're all challenged. Yes. This is Kate, right?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Anna yes. kind of asked a similar question, so I had some stuff kind of answered. And you kind of went into stuff about first love, and I thought it was interesting that you said most people have it when they're teenagers, and I didn't experience it until I was about 19 to 21, and it was with somebody that I was a roommate of mine, and we were very close friends, and I was madly in love, and he looked at me as more of like a little sister figure.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of love there both ways, just a different kind of love. And there was never a physical relationship. And it's still to this day, 10 years later, is the only love relationship I've ever been in. I've been in two relationships since where they were long-term. I almost married one, but it was, I kind of gave up on this. Like that was the one, that was the only
no, no, no,
love
no,
experience I was.
What was his first name?
What was what?
Your first love's name. First name.
Jesse.
Well, you and Jesse, the reason why you were more in love with him, because you were lovers in one lifetime and you were married in two other lifetimes.
Okay.
That's why it felt so hard for him in this lifetime. You weren't done with the relationship, and he was.
Okay.
And that's why I'm still...
Okay, well, originally, I wasn't even thinking about that. I mean, I think about it every day, but not for this call.
Yeah.
It just where the conversation went between you and Anna. But I was originally just wondering, I've always wondered this, and I never feel comfortable bringing it up in my circle because my beliefs are so different from the people I'm surrounded with, but I've always wondered about Jesus and the way he was supposedly a virgin when he ascended and all that. I don't know, obviously, the truth to everything, but I wondered if he did have a soulmate himself, and you also answered that, too, with Mary Magdalene. And so I really don't have a question at this point. I guess I just always wondered because I go into these very deep states of I don't know, like meditation or guided, like I'll be listening to music with lyrics or not, and I'll just be in this true love state, and I feel the presence of my other soul talking to me through various forms, and I can't really describe it, but I know that what I go through then is an understanding that that is not a love I will experience with a human being in my lifetime.
So you're talking about experience the love of your twin flame.
I guess if that's what it's described as.
That kind of energy is unbelievable. I've experienced it, and it's unbelievable. It's a wonderful... It's a wonderful, wonderful energy to be able to reach that level where you can experience it, okay?
Almost nightly. And sometimes it's just loving and it's peaceful and it's just a presence I prefer to be in at all times if I can stay there. But obviously life goes on. You have to get out and go and be. But
the truth is in your physical body, you would not be able to walk around in that energy all the time because you would self-combust.
Right.
It's a very high vibration.
Yes. And then there's times where it's so strong and I get hit with just the right poetry in a song or something I'd never heard before and I can't stop crying for sometimes 6 hours at a time. It's just this
I would suggest,
very
Amy, that
sorrowful.
This is what I would suggest, Amy. I would suggest that when you get into that energy, start sending out that healing energy to somebody that maybe you don't love or someone you do love. You can channel that energy into healing energy.
Okay.
Okay. And it's a wonderful way to keep it flowing in into the universe, into the earth, into whatever your desire is to heal yourself or somebody else, or just that you can channel that and send it to somebody. Our groups, individuals, whatever you desire to do with it, it's a wonderful energy, and you can do that. And that'll actually...
Yeah, I naturally, naturally that kind of occurs to me. I've never thought to intentionally direct it at someone or a group, but it eventually does become just an awareness of, you know, a kind of sorrowful, like, humanity as a whole, just kind of a... I don't know, it almost feels like the sorrow of humanity, but it's a beautiful feeling too.
Right.
I don't cry in any other situations in life usually. So, it's very healing. It feels very good, but it's just so sad to feel like that love is not going to be a realized, thing in my life as it may be for other people who seem to be able to get married and be happily married their lives.
You don't know that. I mean, if you have a desire for that, then you need to put that out with that loving energy that you receive. You need to give
okay.
some that away. You need to give some of it away.
Okay, but do you think that would be the same as say my twin flame love with Jesse in our previous lives?
it's a very strong, you and Jesse had a very strong connection. It has to do with what you're willing to let go of and what you're willing to receive. So if you're already feeling a high vibration of love, you most certainly can channel that out. And that opens up all kinds of doors and all kinds of energies for you.
Okay.
Okay. If you used
okay,
to use
great.
It now, you, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, great.
Yeah, do, and just trust it. That's all.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, and our next caller is Amy on line two. Amy, can you hear us?
It's amazing how this happens. I hope she's hearing, listening to us.
I'm just wondering, Marita, if it has something to do with what's going on with BBS.
Okay, thank you. Amy, can you speak up and say hello? Amy, can you speak up? Well, the station has just confirmed that Amy's on line two, and for whatever reason, she's not hearing us.
Oh, wow. Maybe she needs to turn up her volume.
Well, it happened with the
Hello.
Yeah.
Oh, here. Hi. Okay, now.
Can anybody hear me?
Glad to have you here. Yes, we can, and we're happy to have you here. What's your question?
My name's Amy.
Hi, Amy.
I just had a question. Me and my husband, we've been together 23 years. We have four wonderful children. We've never been happier. And we met when I was 19. My dreams got me to him. I didn't really know him, but I kept having dreams. My dreams always told me whether he was the one or not. So when I was in relationships, my dreams would always tell me he's not the one. He's not the one, so I would end it. And then when I met David, he was my boss, and I didn't really know him, but I kept having dreams about him. He was the one. I was supposed to be with him. He was the one. And it turned out we crossed paths so many times throughout our lives. We worked at so many of the same, you know, companies. We had relatives down the street from each other. We crossed paths so many times but didn't even know it. And my husband keeps swearing that in a past life he was so mean to me and he cheated on me and he was so mean. And he brings that up all the time. So I just wanted to know, was he? Did we know each other in a past life?
Oh, you absolutely did, because you had a contract to come in to make it all right, to make this a loving one. He's the one that actually doesn't want me to talk about him, believe it or not. It's almost like you have to prove to him that you love him. And that's why he keeps bringing that up all the time. He's really testing to see how you love him unconditionally. So tell him to knock it off.
Okay.
Just tell him to knock it off. Fine. You don't want to hear that anymore. The part of the dreaming part is that your soul telling you to get ready for the real one that's coming.
Okay.
And that's why you recognize them. It's not unusual for two people to end up together with this kind of a contract and their energies keep missing each other, but they're right around the corner from each other. And oftentimes they'll be in the same places, they'll know the same people, but they don't run into each other until the time is right.
Right.
Yeah.
And we've just had such an explosive relationship. Even the first time we kissed, it was just so much electricity there.
That's the reuniting of the souls.
Yeah, and then we never seemed to get time together. Something's always pulling us apart, and we were able to spend time on the 888 portal, and we never felt any energy like that in our whole life. He still keeps talking about that energy. It just felt so different. We just couldn't explain it.
You don't have to explain. You just have to experience it. That's all.
Yeah, but it was nice. We felt it was good for the planet. We always feel like maybe we're here to anchor in the energies for the planet.
You just hear as examples of love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
And I love you on the show. And thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Lisa, can you speak up? See if we can hear you.
Hi. Yes, I can hear
Lisa.
You. Hi.
Hi.
Well, I tell you, I have had such a role with my life. I've been absolutely single, never married, going on 60 years old. Never really found the love of my life. I thought I did it several times, but that wasn't it. And all I've done was been a single mom. And I'm to the point now, all I do is get on these calls and learn about spirituality and when is this big event going to happen. And that's all I do. So I just sit home alone. And it's like, okay, I'm ready to leave now. Lord, please just come get me. You know, I'm ready. So it's like I have this will to not be here.
I don't think that you leaving is a geographical cure. Okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you came into the planet to discover and learn about love.
Mm-hmm.
And part of your problem is you have a difficult time receiving and you like to mm-hmm. be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
So you might want to take a look at that, because if you come across as being really very strong, and you most certainly sound like you're a very strong woman, you might want to allow the feminine side of you to come out,
mm-hmm.
the soft side, and bring that out a little more. You know, ask your soul and ask whatever belief systems you have or your twin flame who's on the higher levels to help you with the self-love and the softness so that you're more open to receiving love. Okay?
And okay.
Because my guess is you're not going to leave this earth until you experience it.
Oh, goodness.
Well, it seems to be a mission and such a strong desire that you have. So you have to begin with the self-love.
Okay.
and whoever comes in is going to love you, they're going to have to do an awful lot of convincing because you're not going to believe them.
I think you're right.
Okay, so you might want to just pay attention to that, okay? See what's in your system and see what's in your belief system about that. So if you don't, okay, so you have a trust issue.
Oh, very, very much.
Oh, well, now, you understand, Lisa. How can you allow someone to come in to love you if you have a trust issue?
Well, yeah, it's a lot of work.
Well, you can always ask for help, and it's amazing if you get the insight and understand it. It can all change in the blink of an eye. It really just ask for it. Ask for the miracles, okay? Because you'll get
I
them.
Will. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, dear.
Okay. Well, we've had some interesting callers this evening. Is there anyone else that would like to call in and ask a question?
Now, I'm a little amazed. I'm a little amazed that it has generated so many calls. I think it's wonderful.
Well, it is. And 888-429-5471. We probably have time for one.
No, Kate did get through. We talked to Kate.
Well,
unless it's certain Kate. But Tara was asking a question, so she can ask her. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, Tara.
She can finish her question.
Okay, I got my microphone in my mouth. Is that better?
What is it? A Doug? A Debbie?
Oh. Okay.
Debbie on line one. Okay. Speak up, Debbie. We hear you.
You can hear me?
Yes. We can hear you, Debbie.
Wonderful. This is such a treat. Wow. Thank you. I think that I met and had the privilege of spending time with someone who, in retrospect, I believe was my soulmate. And I am in my late 50s now, and I have almost made peace with the fact that, you know, maybe there just isn't anyone else here for me in this incarnation, and that perhaps my twin flame or other soulmates are in other dimensions or for now. Do you get any sense of whether that's the case or
well, Debbie, let me challenge you how you think, first of all, because you just mentioned that you think you found your love.
No, I know I love him, but unfortunately
I'm just challenging how you think, because I want to know what you feel, because that's the real indicator. Not that you think you love somebody. You either feel it or you don't.
I absolutely love him, and that continues, you know. That's eternal, even though he made his transition in 2001.
And do you want to know if you were with him before, you mean?
I'm just wondering, because the way I understood it was like you could have many soulmates, but only one twin flame. Is that true?
Yes. But our twin flame usually does not incarnate with us and end up with us.
And I'm thinking the twin flame may be on another dimension and perhaps...
The twin flame, your twin flame is in the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm. Now, will I meet my twin flame after we have the ascension?
Yes, after you ascend, you will. There's a lot of long roads to go. Then maybe that'll be a subject for another night. There's a long road to go before you get to ascension. But if we understand and if we have insight, we can do it very quickly. It still comes to raising the consciousness, and it comes to letting go of our belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing against religion. I was born an Irish Catholic and raised an Irish Catholic, and we have some of the strongest belief systems. But religion sometimes stops our growth in spirituality.
So true.
Okay, yes, so they're two separate entities.
So
if you stay on your spiritual path, then that's a much quicker road to ascension. I mean, eventually we're all going to ascend because the soul has no time. There's no time in the spiritual world. There's just a purpose in the spiritual world, and that's to return to where we came from. And that's where we reunite with our twin flame. So you most certainly can call upon your twin flame to help you anytime you need it.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. That's available to us all the time. We're connected.
Oh.
And that's out of love.
Do you think that... Well, I see a lot of women who, like the caller before me, you know, we're single, and we can have pretty contented lives and families.
Absolutely.
And like that. But there aren't, well, I mean, you know, there are a lot of women that are single. And
there's a lot of women that are single out of choice. I mean, one of the things about if we want someone in our life out of need, it rarely works. But if we want someone in our lives because we want them, then that's a whole different energy altogether. And some people make the choice with women with more independence and being able to stand on their own power and their own feet, so to speak, and take care of themselves. They don't need someone to take care of them, but they might want someone to share their lives with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to have that choice is part of the spiritual growth.
Now you got me wondering. I guess I did choose that I don't want anyone to, because I don't want a distraction from my spiritual work, really, right now.
The thing is, you still can be in a relationship and still be on your spiritual journey. If the other person doesn't agree with you, they just need to respect it. Okay, because that's what love is all about. And if you love somebody unconditionally, you may not do a lot of the things they do, but you definitely want to command a respect for it.
Mm-hmm. It's just that person just isn't in my life. The quality of the energy that I had with the guy that I believe to be my soulmate, the past, the quality of the energy was just so pure, so easy, just so, you know, accepting of who I was, and I accepted who he was. And then with other relationships and dating, it seems to just be altogether different. It's so much effort of, you know, trying to, I don't want to say please the other person, but not, and also not quite being able to be yourself or me. I, you know, I'm sure it's all me, you know.
I think that's your test. I think it's your test that whatever people you have in your life are significant to other, you can't be themselves around you. That has to do with you learning to stand in your own power. Because that's your test. You know, you're being tested to see, are you adapting to that person's needs or are you honoring yourself? So that's what you have to take a look at. Now, that will change the dynamics of the relationship, and you may have some fear around that. But that's all part of growth.
Wow.
So it's something to think about.
Oh, yes, a lot to think about.
Yeah. Well, that's challenging some of your fears.
I tell you, I've done the work.
Just love yourself enough to honor yourself, okay?
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Do we have any more callers here?
Now maybe we can answer Tara's question.
Okay. You want to try again, Tara? And then we are about the end of the hour, but doesn't matter if we go over a little bit, I guess.
Oh, my God. I think it's just a very awesome call. I really enjoy these calls with you, Amina. I'm just so grateful to have to be, I mean, have to have the opportunity to be with you every time that you get to be. I just want to know that now. And again, I was just observing how the evolution of these calls with you has gone and how many people do come. And, you know, once in a while there's not so many, but, you know, how people get cold feet, but then now they're getting warmed up. And I think it's because of the love that you have. And okay. And I think that this word consciousness, that's where the magic that we're talking about, when it hits and it's undeniable, that's what it is. In other words, there may be different talents in each individual soul and different experiences, yet on that feeling body realm, which is really a very high vibration, the high heart energy, feeling energy, that like everybody, just about everybody on this call said, I don't have any way to describe it in words. And that experience, when it comes to the everyday life, then the challenges come.
Right.
And so, again, as it's recognized in the feeling body, yet there hasn't been enough study maybe or experience of that energy in terms of a spiritual way of being so that you actually can have more consciousness about it. You know, that magic can be electric, yet and the consistency of that type of energy is another story when the karma is also there too.
Right.
And then, you know, in the times that we live in right now, there are also issues where things are much more almost dangerous as you're not aware of things, you know, in consciousness. And then when you're deciding whether or not you're going to have a child, when the things are going on the way they're going on with not enough consciousness about that. It could be a danger to the child as well as to the, you know, the mother and the father. And so that's where I know what is that fine line between having compassion and just caving to what that spiritual chutzpah that's required when you're going to decide to have a child. Where is that line?
I have no idea. I think that, I mean, I think that someone is deciding to have children and can't make up their minds. I think they have to take a look at what their fears are about becoming a parent. I really do.
Oh, well, I don't think it's about that. I wasn't saying that. One of the partners feels the love, yet is aware that there are some dangers in terms of the other partner, in terms of having enough of the consciousness of what this is all about at this time. And therefore, it's not about she really wants to have a child. And she says, really good man. And I love him very, very much. And then I said, okay, but now these are practical issues. So I'm going to ask you these couple of things. Are you willing, should this come to a place down the road where you got to make a decision that you might need to raise that child by yourself? You know, that might be a calling to the danger of what these kinds of issues that haven't lifted up in consciousness with the other person could actually ask you to do. And then she went, huh. You know,
that's almost like setting up, you know, it's almost like setting up, I'll have a child under all these circumstances. It's very conditional how I'm going to have a child. I have to have this. Yeah. It's like looking for a guarantee, and there's no guarantees.
No, there's no guarantees.
No. So it's like, maybe, I don't know, whoever this lady is, she may want to re-examine what it is about her that's making her hesitate when she has this real desire to have a child, because there's, you know, the father-to-be, if he's going to be a father, is the perfect person right now, perhaps, but we can all project the awful things in life. And if we did that, none of us would be here. None of our children would be here. None of our grandchildren would be here. You know, we just wouldn't exist. So I don't know. It's about, maybe it's about realigning their spiritual desires and trusting. And what's the reason for having a baby? I don't know. With this particular person, right. But it's...
Well, I know one of the reasons that she was saying is that I'm 40, going on 41 almost, and she's worried that she won't be able to have a child if she doesn't have it now.
Well, she's definitely struggling.
Uh-huh.
I can tell you she's afraid. That's all I can tell you.
That's what I think, too.
And it's karmic, okay? So you can tell her it's karmic.
Okay.
Because she's done this before and it didn't work out too good, so she's carrying that fear from another lifetime.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you, sister. Okay, I got my question answered in 5 minutes or less. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
Well, you know, one of the things that we haven't even talked about all evening or mentioned it is that if people would like to have a full reading with you or contact you, how would they reach you?
They can go onto my website, Omena, Omena 777.com, and they can email me from there. They can email me at omenacenter777@gmail.com, and they can pay for a reading through PayPal on my website. And when they write to me, then I set up a private time to where I can talk with them. Reading usually lasts an hour or sometimes more. I ask them to have questions ready, but I also ask them to find some way to tape it. I'm still working on that on my end, where I can tape it and send it to them, because I think that's important. So, and I welcome all calls, and I have gotten quite a few from this show, which I'm grateful for. So there.
Okay. And if for some reason we do have some listeners that are not on the computer, is there any way that they could make a phone call and leave you a message?
860-871-6076. And please leave a message and I will call you back. If I don't answer the phone, I most certainly will call back.
Let's repeat it one more time because sometimes they don't have their pen in their hand.
That's true. 860-871-6076. 860-871-6076.
Well, we are so grateful for you giving us of your time every month here and agreeing to do this. It's been very well received, and I have a lot of good comments that I received from people. So thank you very much, Amina. We are so grateful for your time.
Thanks.
And we'll look forward to the third Thursday next month.
Well, yes, maybe I'll do it on consciousness.
We could do that.
On all the different levels. We'll see.
Right.
I'll be guided to do whatever I'm going to do it on. And I appreciate being here. I most certainly do enjoy it. And thank you so much, Marietta.
Okay. Well, we'll ask to take our musical break here. If the station can put on the Brandenburg, we'll listen to that. And then we'll come back for the last hour with Tara and Rama.
Thank you.
Greetings, everybody. Oh, I'm sorry, Marita. Go ahead.
No, just welcome back to the third hour of our Stargate Roundtable with Tara and Rama for this last hour. So I pass the talking stick.
Thank you, sister. Okay, without much further ado, we're going to jump into, we're only going to be able to play a first section of this. But this is, I think, a very worthwhile. We had this long talk with our sister Omina about love and on the political stratosphere and how we do this with love. I think that the topic here with these two leaders of Black Lives Matter meeting with Hillary Clinton will teach us a whole lot. So I think we're going to just go right into it because it's 9:13 and it's time to get ready to go. Okay, we're going to change the furniture here, everybody.
It's coming along.
DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Black Lives Matter activists are back in the news after confronting Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. Following a campaign event in New Hampshire, a group of Black Lives Matter activists from Massachusetts met with Clinton. What followed was a 16-minute conversation during which this pressed Clinton to address her support of the crime bill that her husband, former President Bill Clinton, signed into law in 1994. That legislation led to the largest increases in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history. Hillary Clinton had lobbied heavily for lawmakers to pass the crime bill, which included $9.7 billion in prison funding and tougher sentencing provisions.
Speaking before the annual Women in Policing Conference in 1994, Hillary Clinton said, quote, "We need more police. We need more and tougher prison sentences for repeat offenders. The three strikes and you're out for violent offenders has to be part of the plan. We need more prisons to keep violent as long as it takes to keep them off the street," she said. Well, in a moment, we'll be joined by two of the Black Lives Matter activists who talked with Hillary Clinton last week. But first, let's turn to a part of their exchange. It begins with Dinesha Yancey of Black Lives Matter Boston.
But you and your family have been personally and politically responsible for policies that have caused health and human services disasters in impoverished communities of color through the domestic and international war on drugs that you championed as First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State. And so I just want to know how you feel about your role in that violence and how you plan to reverse it.
Well, you know, I feel strongly, which is why I had this town hall today, and you know, the questions and the comments from people illustrated. There's a lot of concern that we need to rethink and redo what we did in response to a different set of problems. And, you know, in life, in politics, in government, you name it, you got to constantly be asking yourself, is this working? Is it not? And if it's not, what do we do better? And that's what I'm trying to do now on drugs, on mass incarceration, on police behavior and criminal justice reform, because I do think that there was a different set of concerns back in the 80s and the early 90s. And now I believe we have to look at the world as it is today and try to figure out what will work now. And that's what I'm trying to do. That's what I intend to do as president.
Yeah, and I would offer that it didn't work then either, and that those policies were actually extensions of white supremacist violence against communities of color. And so I just think I want to hear a little bit about that, about actually while those policies were being enacted, they were ripping apart families and actually causing death.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with you. I'm not sure I disagree that any kind of government action often has consequences. And certainly the war on drugs, which started back in the 80s, right, has had consequences. Increasing penalties for crime and three strikes and you're out and all of those kinds of actions have had consequences. But it's important to remember, and I certainly remember, that, you know, there was a very serious, crime wave that was impacting primarily communities of color in 14
Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton responding to a question posed by Dinesha Yancey of Black Lives Matter after a campaign event in New Hampshire last week. Well, Dinesha joins us now here in New York, along with Julius Jones of Black Lives Matter Worcester, who also questioned Clinton about her criminal justice record. Welcome to Democracy Now! In a moment, we're going to play a longer part of the encounter you both had. But Dinesha, explain the scene. How did you meet up with Hillary Clinton? You, unlike other Black Lives Matter moments in presidential campaign history of the last few months where people interrupted public events, you were actually brought to her privately?
Yeah, so we went to New Hampshire with the intention of confronting Hillary Clinton in the public forum. There was a forum she was hosting on substance abuse. Unfortunately, when we got there, we were told that we couldn't come inside. Dan Marica actually recognized me.
It was crowded?
That's the reason that we were given, was capacity. And so he was tweeting that we weren't able to get in, and then someone came
out. This is a reporter from CNN.
Yes. And so someone came out and invited us into an overflow room where we could actually watch the forum. And then one of her staffers came in and said, we could offer you a couple of minutes with her. And we said, absolutely, so that we could ask her the questions that we had.
And did she know you were filming her?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And were you surprised that the conversation, Julius, lasted as long as it did?
Yeah, it was actually kind of shocking. I think she was taking the opportunity to give us enough time and space to satisfy the concerns of that were raised by us not being let in. Mm-hmm. It felt as if it was strategic on the campaign's part, and it was probably pretty smart that they didn't let the story get out that we were shut out of the meeting. But I think the direction that the conversation went in was probably unexpected by her in the mm-hmm. campaign. And it was a very candid, open, and honest, frank Hillary Clinton, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about Dinesha, before we go into the question. The next question that Julius asks, the issues you were raising in this first encounter with her that we just played?
Well, we wanted to hear from her a personal reflection on her participation in promoting policies through the war on drugs that have increased our mass incarceration that we're in today. That Hillary Clinton and the Clintons hold a unique space in our country's politics. And so to be at having a forum on substance abuse and to not recognize her own role in the war on drugs that has actually been a war on drug users, we felt like we really need to hold her accountable to that history.
And in what capacity was she responsible? Talk about her history, how you hold her responsible.
Well, she advocated for, as FLOTUS and as senator, for policies that have increased the penalties for minor drug offenses and things like that. Back in 94, there was $17 billion divested from HUD, from public housing, and $19 billion put into prison construction. And so with situations like that that we've seen her publicly support, we really wanted to hear from her what has changed in her that she would not continue to promote practices like that.
And how do you respond to folks who say that, well, the Black Lives Matter now has been confronting several Democratic candidates, but the Republican candidates, of which there are many more, have largely been so far unscathed in questions of answering their policy issues in terms of the Black community and of police violence and mass incarceration?
Yeah, presidential candidate should expect to hear from us and expect to be held accountable. It's actually a practice called power mapping where it's similar to lobbying where you actually map who's closest to you on the issue and go to those folks first in order to force them to articulate their stance and then hold them accountable to it. So this movement is very strategic and that's what we've been doing.
We want to turn to the next part of the interaction. Talk about how long you had with her. There were campaign staffers around. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a room. It was probably full of 20 people. There were five folks with us and 15 with her. And then the four or five people that you see on camera, there was probably another six on either side of the person who was filming. And it was a decent amount of time. It was like 15 minutes. It felt like it lasted forever.
So this is Julius Jones questioning Hillary Clinton.
The truth is that there's an extremely long history of unfortunate government practices that don't work, that particularly affect black people and black families. Mm-hmm. And until we as a country, and then the person who's in the seat that you seek, actually addresses the anti-blackness current that is America's first drug. We're in a meeting about drugs, right? America's first drug is free black labor and turning black bodies into profit. And the mass incarceration system mirrors an awful lot like the prison plantation system. It's the same. It's a similar thread, right? And until someone takes that message and speaks that truth to white people in this country so that we can actually take on anti-blackness as a founding problem in this country, I don't believe that there's going to be a solution. And I genuinely want to know, you, Nathan, have been in no uncertain way partially responsible for this, more than most, right? Now, there may have been unintended consequences, but now that you understand the consequences, what in your heart has changed that's going to change the direction of this country? And what in you, like, not your platform, not what you're supposed to say, like, how do you actually feel that's different than you did before? Like, what were the mistakes, and how can those mistakes be lessons for all of America? For a moment of reflection on how we treat black people in this country.
Your analysis is totally fair. It's historically fair, it's psychologically fair, it's economically fair. But you're going to have to come together as a movement and say, here's what we want done about it. Because you can get lip service from as many white people as you can pack into Yankee Stadium and a million more like it, who are going to say, oh, we get it, we're going to be nicer, okay? That's not enough, at least in my book. That's not how I see politics. So the consciousness raising, the advocacy, the passion, the youth of your movement is so critical. But all I'm suggesting is, even for us sinners, find some common ground on agendas that can make a difference right here and now in people's lives. And that's what I would love to, you know, have your thoughts about, because that's what I'm trying to figure out how to do. So, yeah, deal with mass incarceration. It's not just an economic issue, although I grant you some people see it like that. But it's more than that. I think there is a sense like, you know, low-level offenders, disparity in treatment, we got to do something about that. I think that a lot of the issues about housing and about job opportunities, ban the box, a lot of these things, let's get an agenda that addresses as much of the problem as we can. Because then you can be for something, in addition to getting people to have to admit that they're part of a long history in our country of either proposing, supporting, condoning discrimination, segregation, etc. Now, what do we do next? And that's what I'm trying to figure out in my campaign. So that's what I'm doing.
That is the perfect.
Thank you. Really
thank you.
The piece that's most important, and I stand here in your space, and I say this as respectfully as I can, but if you don't tell black people what we need to do, then we won't tell you all what you need to do.
Well, I'm not telling you. I'm just telling you to tell me.
What I mean to say is that this is and has always been a white problem of violence. It's not, there's not much that we can do to stop the violence against us.
Well, if that is
a conversation that I push back.
Okay, I understand.
And
I understand what you're saying.
So respectfully.
Yeah. Well, respectfully, if that is your position, then I will talk only to white people about how we are going to deal
that's
with the very
I mean.
Real
that's
problems.
That's not what I mean. That's not what I mean.
No.
But like what I'm saying is you what you just said was a form of victim blaming. Right? You were saying that what the Black Lives Matter movement needs to do to change white hearts is
I'm not talking about. Look, I don't believe you change hearts.
I believe you change laws, you change allocation of resources, you change the way systems operate. You're not going to change every heart. You're not. But at the end of the day, we can do a whole lot to change some hearts and change some systems and create more opportunities for people who deserve to have them to live up to their own God-given potential, to live safely without fear of violence in their own communities, to have a decent school, to have a decent house, to have a decent future. So we can do it one of many ways. You know, you can keep the movement going, which you have started, and through it, you may actually change some hearts. But if that's all that happens, we'll be back here in 10 years having the same conversation.
That's Julius Jones speaking with Hillary Clinton and Dinesha Yancey as well of the Black Lives Matter movement, Boston and Worcester. They went up to Keene, New Hampshire. She was holding a forum on substance abuse, and they were actually brought to her backstage afterwards. Were you satisfied, Julius, with her answer to you?
I think we got to her in a way that made it feel like the trip was worth it. The content of the answer I was not satisfied with, because Hillary Clinton gave an answer that I might expect in a normal conversation that I have with your everyday person who is ducking the personal responsibility and just trying to focus on the solution. And that's something that I expect in everyday conversation when I engage with people on this idea. But when it comes to Hillary Clinton and the Clintons in general, they not only occupy a unique space in how they feel, but they are directly responsible for the greatest increase in the prison population under any president. And for her to be confronted with this idea and then immediately say that the movement needs to solve this problem. And then in the backdrop, what she's not saying is what would be in parentheses would be that I created, mm-hmm. like the problem that the Clintons created and perpetuated this long droning history of anti-blackness in the United States. And her visceral reaction, I think, was indicative of how she felt. And I think it was indicative of how perhaps in her own racial introspection, that was the first time that it really occurred to her like that, because it was a very emotional reaction. More emotional than I think we've seen, Hillary.
I think it's one of the more candid moments in the presidential campaign so far of any of the candidates to get her to have to respond off her regular message or prepared notes and have to have an interchange and a back and forth on a subject that she clearly did not relish having, but was also clearly affected or listening to what you had to say. So, I congratulate you for being able to raise those issues. And also, thankfully, that there was a video to let other people see what actually happened.
I wanted to go back and get your comment on the other times that Black Lives Matter have engaged with the Democratic presidential candidates. Earlier this month, two Black Lives Matter activists, Marissa Johnson and Mara Williford, shut down an appearance in Seattle by presidential candidate Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, Seattle, for being one of the most progressive cities in the United States of America.
If you do not listen to her, your event will be shut down right now.
After some negotiation amidst a chorus of boos from the crowd, Marissa Johnson addressed the crowd and held a 4.5-minute moment of silence for Michael Brown, 1 minute for each hour he lay on the street in Ferguson after being gunned down by a police officer August 9, 2014, just over a year ago. Johnson then referenced the confrontation that Black Lives Matter activists had with Sanders and another Democratic presidential candidate, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, earlier this summer at the Netroots Nation conference in Phoenix.
If you believe that Black Lives Matter, as you say you do, then you will join us now in holding Bernie Sanders accountable specifically for his actions.
Senator Sanders appeared on Meet the Press Sunday and spoke to reports that his campaign has apologized for taking so long to reach out to Black Lives Matter activists.
Well, that was sent out by a staffer, not by me. Look, we are reaching out to all kinds of groups. Absolutely. I met with folks at Black Lives Matter. We're reaching out to Latino groups. We're reaching out to the unions. We're fighting to expand Social Security, and we're reaching out to senior groups. We're reaching out to healthcare groups because we believe that everybody in America is entitled to healthcare. We're reaching out to everybody. But on this issue of Black Lives, let me be very clear. The issue that they are raising is a very, very important issue. There's no candidate for president who will be stronger in fighting against institutional racism and, by the way, reforming a broken criminal justice system. Chuck, we have more people in jail in the United States of America than any other country on earth. And we need real changes. We need to do away with the militarization of local police departments. We need to do away with minimum sentencing. We need education and jobs for our young people rather than jails and incarceration.
I understand that, but you said a staffer put it out, but you felt an apology was necessary?
No, I don't. I think we're going to be working with all groups. This was sent out without my knowledge.
Fair enough.
And that was Chuck Todd of Meet the Press speaking with Senator Sanders. Julius Jones, your response to Sanders, the interruptions and the questioning of him, do you feel he's responded adequately?
I feel like his addition of racial justice to his platform has been a good step in the right direction. What he's asked folks to do is to be patient with him and to trust that he will be the best candidate to advance this type of agenda. And I think that even he, who is arguably on the cutting edge of this issue, does not understand the emergency, the urgency that we're in this struggle, because it's not just a item on a long list of agendas in United. Most of us, it's our families being devastated in the slow form through poverty, the loaded gun that is poverty at the Black community's head. It's faster in the prison, like with families who are broken up by their family members being in prison. And then it's the rapid, violent version in police brutality. Last time I checked, the Counted Project, who is keeping track of police murders, police killings in the United States, is up to 731. It's on pace to topple. And proportionally, it's disproportionately against Black people. We have live statistics that are showing the urgency of this, unlike ever before. And Bernie Sanders is not treating it justly.
I wanted to finish. We've been talking about the presidential candidates. What about the sitting president and his changes in the last year or two in addressing some of the issues of mass incarceration and an unjust justice system? What do you think about his policies?
I think that he needs to be held just as accountable as anyone seeking or in this office, right? And so right now we are focused on this presidential race, but absolutely, folks have raised that concern, and I think that he doesn't get off either. No president of the United States has ever stood for Black lives in a strong and an effective way, because I mean we're in the situation that we're in now, right?
Finally, how you ended up founding Black Lives Matter chapter in Boston, and you, Julius, representing Black Lives Matter in Worcester, Massachusetts?
It was through the Black Lives Matter's ride to Ferguson last year in August of 2014. Mike Brown was killed on August 9th, and we were down in Ferguson by August 29th. And we were down there to support the community, to raise the issue, and to bring strategy back home. So that's what we did in founding the chapter in Boston.
And Julius?
Yes, in Worcester, I went to Ferguson a little bit before the nationwide call. And then many months later, I was doing some organizer work in Worcester with a wonderful group, and decided to attempt to bring the national energy of BLM to Worcester.
Well, we thank you so much for being with us. Dinesha Yancey and Julius Jones, activists with Black Lives Matter. You can go to our website, especially for radio listeners, and you can see the interaction between the Black Lives Matter activists in New Hampshire with Hillary Clinton. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at Donald Trump, and particularly his taking on birthright the issue of birthright. Should the Constitution be changed, and how he's affecting other presidential candidates? Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Good.
Okay. Sorry, everybody, but we got to hear the song. It's powerful rap music. Listen carefully to the words. We're going to shift now because we'll play that other section that's really good, too. David K. Johnson had a lot to say. And again, it was said with something of the power of ethics at a deeper level of consciousness. And so now we're going to go to the consciousness of our brother Nassim Haramein and finish the last about 17 minutes here of The Connected Universe, A Fundamental Transformation of Human Awareness or Consciousness. Here we go.
Of the ratio, you guys following this? And the answer was the exact mass of the black hole. The exact mass of the black hole. But in pixels, right? And so that answer is the same answer as Einstein's field equation answer for that black hole. So I solved Einstein's equations just by pixelating the universe. So all of a sudden, gravity and mass is not just this smooth curve described by Einstein, but it's actually quantized, pixelated at the very, very small level, right? So Einstein described gravity as curvature, like when you pull the plug in your bath, the surface of the water starts curving and your rubber ducky starts orbiting, right? Okay, that's what he described. But what I found is that actually the solution is actually all the molecules of water spinning, producing the curvature. The curvature is the consequence of the spinning of the little plunks all together. So you could think of a black hole as actually the structure of the vacuum, like a slurry of these plunks, all spinning together, creating an energy event that has mass. You guys see what I mean? And so I was like, whoa, this is so cool. Quantum gravity, like for real, right? And so then I thought, okay, well, that's the algebraic, you know, I'll spare you that, extrapolation of the geometry. But what was really cool is that, like, when I did the algebra of the geometry, because this is a geometric, like straight up geometry equation, right? I realized that the geometry couldn't be that every Planck was like, was tangential to each other, right? Because that would leave a space between the Planck. The equation said there was no space between the Planck, right? So it couldn't be that. So then the space had to be taken up And when the equation is correct for the black hole, it's because the geometry is in the shape of the flower of life. Just like your t-shirt, which is a symbol that's found in ancient civilization all around the world, in temples all around the world, and that's described as the fundamental pattern of creation and all this stuff. I'm like, dude, these guys had it right. Not just a little bit right. Like, here's the equation, bro. Like, it comes out, you know? It's not just a cool thing that you want to print on a t-shirt, you know? And like in the Forbidden City, for instance, the guardian of the city, the guardian of the knowledge, has his paw on the knowledge. And when you look at the knowledge under the paw, there it is, right? And it's in 3D, like the proton right there, right? Well, at least the black hole. So I'm thinking, okay, I mean, it took me at least 5 years of calculation to go from this step to the next step. So, like, you know, it's not like it happened overnight. But, like, when I found the next step, I couldn't figure out how easily I could have found that. Like, I could have found it the next day, but I went through this crazy calculation insanity for 5 years, not sleeping. Literally, like, nights after nights, like, oh, is this geometry working? And then I finally came to found that if I took the proton, because like if it was quantum gravity, it had to apply at the proton level, right? If the solution was correct, it had to be right for the proton too. So then I calculated how much were on the surface. Again, 10 to the 40th Planck are on the surface of a proton. And then how many are on the inside? 10 to the 60th Planck are on the inside. Now you're starting to feel the sense of the harmonics there, you know, anyway. And so and then I realized that all I had to do was reverse the ratio, because I was at the quantum level. And so now I did the surface over the volume and got a ratio, right? And multiplied it by the Planck mass, and sure enough, it gave me the mass, the proton. And I was like, oh, right? But when it gave me the mass of the proton, it was a little bit wrong. But you know what? I was really happy, because you know what? I'm dealing with 10 to the 60th Planck inside multiplied by 10 minus 5 grams, which is the mass of the universe. So I'm actually dividing the mass of the universe, the mass of all other protons in the universe. Really? Oh! All the other... Give me just a little more. Okay. All the other protons in the universe to the surface of the one proton, and I'm getting within 0.0012 of the mass that's measured in the laboratory. Okay? Like, so, you know, I'm dealing with mass that are 10 to the 55 grams, and I'm getting a mass that's 10 to minus 24 grams. Like, the mass of a proton is teeny, and it's coming out. Like, how, the chance of that being like some fluke is like, no way, right? This is real. And so, but then I realized, okay, I'll skip the algebra. I realized, oh, but my mass, my measurement is based on the measurement of the radius of the proton, right? Because if the radius of the proton is not exact, then my measurement, my theory may not be exact, right? So I start to look, oh, we know the mass of the proton very exactly, but the radius is a problem. We have a hard time finding exactly what the radius of the proton is. And so I solved the equation for my theory using the Planck as a unit of measurement, right? Which is the smallest unit of measurement you could ever use. So it's going to be precise. And I made a prediction in the paper I published that that radius is actually the right radius, and that thereof, right? It was a gutsy move. And in the paper I mentioned that there was this new measurement of the radius of the proton that had been taken in Switzerland by an accelerator in Switzerland that all the physicists were ignoring because it was 4% wrong to the standard model. The standard model was 4% off the measurement they took, so they were saying it must be wrong. But I put in my paper, well, in fact, that new measurement is very, very good relative to my theory. All right? So maybe it's right, right? And so because it was within 0.00067 of the prediction I made of the proton, right? Of the proton radius. I published a paper with that in it, and 2 months later, an announcement was made that the accelerator in Switzerland had made a new measurement of the proton more precise than the LICE one, and it confirmed the 2010 measurement and with more precision, and it gave the new number, and the new number was now only 0.00036 from my prediction. I was inside the margin of error of their experiment, so my number may still be more precise than what they can measure. And to this day, it is the most precise theoretical, prediction of the radius, the charge radius of the proton, and the mainstream is off by 4%. So, you know, I'm doing really good on that. But, you know, this is why you saw in many public, in popular magazine, a small particle, big problem, the Humble proton is nothing like we expected. No kidding. Because it's a black hole, by the way, and then like more recently others. But I'm going to go really fast through the slides just to get to the punchline here. I showed that this relationship of surface to volume ratio of information in the system is actually a fundamental ratio of the universe. And its relationship is flipping. And basically, you can think of every little plonk as the termination of a wormhole that connects another plonk on another proton. So that the thing is totally like a network wormhole structure that connects all the universe in one whole information network that is learning about itself. And mass is actually the information moving across the system. And so I calculated that interaction, and when I got it, I got the exact force that holds the proton together, but as well the range of the force that holds the protons together, which is not the same as gravity. So I was able to show that gravity, because of that wormhole interaction thing, at the atomic level, is actually giving the correct range that we measure in laboratory for the protons sticking together. And that's called the Yukawa potential. So, and when I finished this, then I calculated, and this is in the paper that's coming out, that's being written with Dr. Almira Valbaker, that at the Resonance Project, that came from England to help me out with all this. But basically, when you calculate how many little plonks there is on all the protons, you end up with that same amount of plonks that are on the surface of the universe. So all the plonks on the surface of all protons is the same as the number of plonks on the surface of the universe. So the wormholes don't stop at the protons. They connect to the surface of the universe, right? So that you can, from every proton in your body, you have access to the whole thing. Like you can blow to the next. You can escape our universe into the next one. I mean, literally, like the whole thing works out. It's remarkable. And And so we're describing a cosmogenesis where the little proton escape our universe. One proton escaping our universe would expand, right? Because it arrives in a larger universe, and then now the vacuum density is much lower. So it would expand very, very rapidly. And that's what we call the Big Bang. It's basically a proton. So it's like, it's biology. It's like a little seed coming out. And then, and so you can imagine universal black holes fizzing with protons emerging that like are expanding and into universes. Universal cosmology, like the whole thing is like fizzing with life, right? And then, And so I calculated if that's plausible, and I found that it's exactly right. When you expand a proton to the size of the universe, you get exactly the density change in the vacuum that is the, you know, that is the difficulty, the largest difficulty they had in the density change between quantum and cosmology that I talked about earlier. And the result is that you can develop a framework of the brain, and this is what I'm publishing with the biologist now, a framework of the brain where the meningine, the surface interaction of the brain with the vacuum structure, gives you the right mathematics for molecular, atomic and subatomic interaction with the vacuum, where the brain is acting like an antenna connecting with the structure of the vacuum at all scales. So for instance, here's the brain cells, here's the universal structure that we can see, and here's the Planck interaction of the wormholes at the Planck level, all connecting the scales. I'm going really fast here, but you know, I have more details for this coming up. But you know, this is now actually being applied in technology as well. So nowadays, drives that are pushing against the vacuum that are emerging, that have been tested in NASA. You know, there's NASA initiatives to create warp drives using the vacuum structure. This is no longer fringe physics. This is getting more and more accepted and mainstream, and experiments are proving it. This is another experiment with superconductors that are jumping, that are creating gravitational fields and gravitational beams. And those have been confirmed now in laboratory and not my laboratory. So, you know, at the Resonance Project, we are building some of these devices. And, you know, because I was there 25 years ago, right? And so I'm a little bit ahead of the curve there. And so basically the idea is that we can take the space and engage the vacuum, engage the information in the space to create our own little slurry, right? To create our own little gravitational event, which we can control with the magnetic field, so we can lift right off this planet. We can extract massive amount of energy, and we can totally transform our world. And this is real. It's not like 10 generations from now. It's like happening right now in laboratories. And this is why, you know, we have to keep moving. And, you know, the delegate program is such a great thing to do, because we just launched this thing online and you can go through all the stuff at your own rhythm and learn about it and all this stuff, and then support the Resonance Project as well. And I'm going to discuss that on Monday in this little seminar thing. And we're going to have like question and answer, and we're going to have a whole bunch of fun. So come and check it out on Monday. Thanks, you guys. Woo! Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Okay, everybody. On that note, I don't think I remember to tell you this. I've been talking about it in a lot of places. But, Dr. Keshe has two devices now. They are for sale, and they're selling them in Europe, and they take 30 days to deliver. That's the guarantee in any of the countries in Europe. On a global basis, they take 90 days. Yet, I'm going to say it right now, this must mean that he knows something we don't. in terms of the fact that Nasara now, because the United States will never let one of his things into this country without something happening to take these guys to task. And arrests is what we need. But the two devices, one for the car and one for the home. The one for the home is about 3 feet tall and 8 inches in diameter, and itself stands free. It's free energy. You don't need to pay another electric bill or another gas bill ever in your life. And that will be about $790 for the unit. And so that's one. And the other one in the car, as you have an electric car, you'll never have to plug the car in again. Never. It'll be like having a car with doesn't need anything except just drive it until it drops. And then the as you have a gasoline, I think it's like 1/10 of the amount that you use now is what you still need to use with that free energy device. So that's just the beginning. There's 50,000 of these things like this in the wings. So believe in the magic that our brother just was speaking of, Nasara now. And, you know, these guys are still pushing. It started with Nixon and Henry Kissinger and in Israel's prime minister at the time, Golden Meir. And, I mean, they did this secret agreement where ultimately the State Department and the National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger prevailed. They thought that as they didn't pressure Prime Minister Golden Meir too much on the nuclear question, it would be easier to get her to make tough choices in the peace talks. There would be much more debate, more instability, as Israel announced what they were doing. So from Henry Kissinger's perspective, it was better that they not announce anything, that they don't announce the fact that they have nuclear weapons, that they don't test the weapons to keep it basically secret and concealed. And then another good goal for Nixon was to get the Israelis to sign the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, yet as he met Golden Meir at the White House, they agreed to delay that step as well because Golden Meir was facing elections at home. Israel has to this day never signed the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, and it's never publicly confirmed that it has any nuclear weapons whatsoever. More insight into the military balance of power in the Middle East and how the United States government tried and failed to shape it. Okay, so that's the end of that report, and it's time to go now. But know that Ashtar will never allow any nukes to go off into the active stage. Nasara now, and we'll see you tomorrow and in your dreams. And on the ships. And I guess I better quickly, magically open the page here real quick, see what I can hear and say. Okay. The shark is killed for its fin. The rhino is killed for its horn. The tiger is killed for its skin. What price the unicorn? And what that's saying is the price of peace. Peace now. We love you all, and we'll see you tomorrow, like I said. And namaste. And music, maestro.